This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thank you for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
So we are going to start by looking at the humanitarian disaster happening right now in Ethiopia. For this, we'll go straight to Brent.
Yes, we reported on this last week, but we do need to give it more attention just because it is threatening to spiral out of control to the point of civil war in Ethiopia. And this is violence that's taking place in the northern state or province of Ethiopia, the Tigray region. And it would be really helpful as you listen to this just to have a map, because you can see how violence in this region could affect the entire Horn of Africa region. What we reported last week is that on November 4th or November 5th, you had the leader of Ethiopia, who has been at odds with the Tigrayan national government, or the Tigrayan state government, let's call it that, refusing to hold elections this past year. And the Tigrayans went ahead and held their local provincial elections in defiance of the leader of Ethiopia. And since that time, you've had increasing back and forth, violent back and forth between the government of Ethiopia and the Tigrayan state. And this has spiraled out of control over the past week. You've had reports of a massacre that took place yesterday or the day before in basically the border region between Sudan, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. Already, there's about 20,000 refugees that have flooded into Sudan from Ethiopia. You've also had reports that there have been massive airstrikes from the Ethiopian government on the Tigrayan forces. And the Ethiopian government has basically said, we are not going to negotiate with the Tigrayans. They are going to have to be forced to submit. Their leaders are going to have to be arrested and tried for trying to break up Ethiopia as they would see it.
We talked about this, I believe, last week, and the concern that this violence in this part of North Africa and the Horn of Africa really has the potential to blow up into a much bigger conflict. Can you explain why that is the case?
Well, Ethiopia itself is a heavily sectarian country with lots of different ethnicities, Muslim, Christian, but then you've got the different tribes as well. And the way that it's set up, back in 2018, you had the Abiy Ahmed come into power. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his peace with Eritrea. But he basically said, well, let's all get together, and looking forward, we might try and revolutionize our constitution, which basically says that every one of these statelets that is ethnically separate from one another, they have the chance to secede whenever they want to. That's in their constitution. So Tigray can actually secede if it wants to. And so what we're seeing here is that while Ethiopia, the government of Ethiopia, is focusing on trying to put down rebellions in Tigray, earlier this year we had other provinces that were trying to fight against the Ethiopian government as well. And right now you have Ethiopian forces that are inside Somalia, over 4,500 next door, trying to protect the Somalian government from Al-Shabaab, the terrorist organization there. They're going to have to be pulled out of Somalia back into Ethiopia to help this fight. That may make the Somalian government much more weak there as well. There's also reports that just to the north of Tigray is Eritrea. And Eritrea, there's rumors that Eritrea has actually started fighting against Tigray as well. And so they are going to be drawn into this conflict. And Sudan, for its part, it's right now got a weak government, a government that's just doing deals with Israel. But the people of Sudan don't like their government. And so it's dangerous as well that this could flood over, or at least refugees from Tigray could actually destabilize the Sudan as well. Now, just as a bit of perspective, we're talking about a province that has 6 million people, but it has an army that's potentially stronger than the Ethiopian army. You have 250,000 people there that belong to its militia or police force. You have the Northern Command of Ethiopia that is part of the official Ethiopian army. But there's conflicting reports now that the Northern Command of the Ethiopian army is actually siding with the Tigrayans. Most of that army in the north are ethnic Tigrayans. And they're in the north because they've been looking after the border between Eritrea and Ethiopia. And so a lot of firepower is really concentrated in this province of Tigray. And so if it does come to increasing blows, as it looks like it will, since none of them are going to turn back from this, mm-hmm. you have, it's not a province trying to break away from Ethiopia with minimal arms. It is state against state violence. And Eritrea, it makes sense, is going to be brought into this as well, because the whole reason peace was worked out between Eritrea and Ethiopia is the mutual hatred of the Tigrayan region. And so I don't want to laugh about this, because it looks like the Tigrayans actually might either go northward towards the Red Sea going forward. And so again, it's the Horn of Africa. We don't really talk about it much. You've got the Red Sea right next door, which is one of the major lanes. 10% of seaborne oil comes through this part of the Red Sea. It's a choke point that Eritrea, Djibouti, just to the western, to the east of Ethiopia, incredibly important strategic locations. And violence here in Tigray has the potential to just bring in Eritrea, Somalia, destabilized Somalia, and also Ethiopia itself, a country with 110 million people.
And when we spoke about this last week, you mentioned just how any destabilization within this region is something that an outside power could take advantage of. Looking at the situation as it's developing, are you still focusing on that inevitability?
Yeah, of course. We're looking at this in terms of biblical prophecy. This is going to be a humanitarian disaster as well, but we're looking for pretty big changes to take place along the Red Sea corridor involving Eritrea, Ethiopia, as based on a biblical prophecy found in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 to 43. This is the prophecy that talks about the King of the South, which is a radical Islamic kingdom led by Iran. And nations are going to fall in tow with Iran as part of this alliance. And the Bible specifically mentions Egypt, it specifically mentions Libya, and it specifically mentions Ethiopia, which in biblical terms is basically everything from the Ethiopian border all the way down, including modern Ethiopia. And so we do expect a radical transformation of Ethiopia from this Christian-dominated country to really falling in line with Iran's goals. And I mean, you just look across the Red Sea to Yemen, and right on the coast there, you do have the Houthi rebels. They are fully in bed with Iran, acting as a proxy of Iran. Iran has talked about how they are now the gatekeeper of the Red Sea. Well, the Bible actually talks about Iran gaining influence on the other side of the Red Sea passageway. And so this is what we're looking for, that which no one else is really looking for, because we have the Bible to show that Iran is going to gain the upper hand out of crises, as it does so well most of the time, anywhere in the region. But we are looking for Iran to gain the upper hold here. It could be through Somalia. It's had an alliance with Al-Shabaab before, the terrorist organization there. It also could be through the Houthis coming across the water and actually working with the Tigrayans. You never know. The Tigrayans will have it their back against the wall, and perhaps they'll reach out for outside help somewhere from somewhere else. It's hard to see how Iran's going to do it, but biblical prophecy says that they are going to gain influence in this part of the world, and they normally do well working in chaotic situations.
Well, that prophecy is explained in Gerald Flory's booklet, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy. We will link to that in the show notes for the program, or you can find that in our literature library. Thank you very much for that, Brent. The strategic importance of this part of Africa was highlighted this week by an announcement from Russia about a military advancement there. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this news broke Wednesday with an announcement that Russia had secured the rights from the nation of Sudan to build a logistics hub for the Russian Navy on Sudan's coast. So this hub will accommodate up to 300 military personnel. And the agreement that Russia and Sudan signed said Russia can have up to 4 warships at this base at a time, including those armed with nuclear weapons. This is it's all part of a pact that the Russians and the Sudanese have made just to, in general, boost their military cooperation. But one interesting and I think very significant part of this is the Red Sea access that this will give to Russia. Sudan has about 500 miles of coastline on the Red Sea, and we don't yet know exactly where the Russian hub will be, but it'll be somewhere along that coast, and that's premium real estate. We know that from the massive amounts of trade that pass through there, all the oil that fuels so many economies, you know, passes largely through there. So this is a notable accomplishment for the Russian Navy specifically, and just for the nation's general ability to project power in one of the world's most important regions.
So we were just talking with Brent about the about Iran's interest in this area. The fact that Russia is wanting to increase its presence there at least demonstrates the strategic importance of this this part of Africa.
Yes, that's right. You know, in general, Russia has increasing interest in Africa, I think, because of its sprawling mineral wealth, because Russia sees those 54 African nations as potential, potentially lucrative markets for all of Russia's weapons that are such a huge export for the Russians. In 2019, we saw Russia host a huge meeting there in Sochi between a lot of African leaders. So I think that indicates just an increase in general in Russia's interest in Africa. But specifically here with Sudan, as I mentioned, that is just a vital shipping lane. And it also aligns with Iran's interests in this area, which we know that Russia and Iran are finding common ground, not in a long-term way, right. I think, but at least temporarily, they're kind of strange bedfellows cooperating across a whole range of issues at present. So there could be something relevant with Iranian interests as well.
So this was not the only breakthrough for Russia's military this week. Explain developments in Azerbaijan.
Yeah, that's right. This was a really big week for Russia because I think at just about the same time that it was hammering out this deal with Sudan, about 1,800 miles away, it was sending troops into Nagorno-Karabakh. That's the disputed area between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And there'd been just intense fighting there for about the last 6 weeks between Azerbaijan and Armenia. But this week, Russia helped to broker a long-term truce between the two. Many are saying that this truce was a win for Azerbaijan because under the terms, Azerbaijan will be allowed to keep the territory that they won. But really, I think this is an even bigger win for Russia. You know, these two nations used to be part of the Soviet Union. And we know from Russian President Vladimir Putin's statements and actions over the years that he wants to rebuild that Soviet Union. Maybe he doesn't want the Soviet Union's politics as they were, but he wants the power that Russia had over its neighbors during that Soviet age. And that desire for Putin has really been at the heart of his invasion of Georgia back in 2008. He was able to assert Russian control over about a fifth of Georgia's territory at that time. And then that same desire was also behind his invasion of Ukraine in 2014. That's when he grabbed some of Ukraine's choicest territory and put it under Russian control. And now he's sending troops into this Nagorno-Karabakh region, and he'll be positioned to just assert more control over it. So it's too soon to say exactly how this will end up, but there are signs that this ceasefire will hold where other recent ones have failed. And at least right now, it looks like Russia and its military are among the victors.
Why are these moves by Russia's military so important, looked at from a prophetic standpoint?
Well, the trumpet vigilantly watches Vladimir Putin and his grasp on power because of what the Bible says about his role in end-time events. The scriptures talk about a huge Asian confederation that will grow very powerful in the modern era. There's a passage in Ezekiel 38 that even gets specific about which countries will be a part of this. And it says that Russia will be the lead nation with a certain individual leading it all. This individual is called the Prince of Russia, or the Prince of Rosh, in the passage there when it's correctly translated. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has identified Putin as that end-time Russian prince. So when we see Putin building up Russia's military and just improving its reach, as we saw in Sudan this week, or when we see him asserting Russia's will in its neighboring states, such as Ukraine or Georgia, or as may very well be beginning to happen there in the Nagorno-Karabakh region after this week's deployments, all of that just gives us a picture of how effectively this man will be able to lead this huge Asian power bloc. And it shows how relevant I think that all of these scriptures are.
Well, we do have a booklet by our editor-in-chief, The Prophesied Prince of Rosh, that we will link to in the show notes for today's program. We also have an article coming up by our writer Mihailo Zekic on the Azerbaijan-Armenia situation. That will be going up on the website early next week, so you can stay tuned and watch for that. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Now to a few items looking at the aftermath of the American election. Some of these from a global perspective. We're going to start in Europe, where leaders couldn't be more excited about the prospect of a Joe Biden presidency. For this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, watching Europe over the weekend was just fascinating. I think everyone's familiar with the story in the United States. You had the media called this event on Saturday. Hasn't been officially called or certified by U.S. officials, but the media called this event. What you saw was Europe jumped right on board with that. Within 15 minutes of CNN saying that Vice President Biden had won the election, the Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin sent his congratulations in to Joe Biden. And then once the German Foreign Minister got on and sent his in, well, then all of the big EU members started sending all their congratulations in. Now, this is unusual. This goes against standard global protocol, standard European protocol. Typically, what you would do is you wait for either an official announcement or for one side to concede. That's the standard protocol, and then you send in your congratulations. This didn't happen. And a lot of people are saying this didn't happen for a very important reason. Politico cited an anonymous EU official saying that all of these leaders deliberately coordinated their statements. The EU Observer wrote, it looked like a coordinated effort to stop outgoing President Donald Trump from challenging the result. So all of these leaders, it would look a bit odd if one leader by themselves broke protocol. Instead, they all got together, they all agreed to do it, and then they did it to maximum effect. You know, if 20 European leaders come out and say congratulations all at once, that doesn't have as much of effect. But if you coordinate it, so every 10, 15 minutes, you've got a different leader coming out and sending in this congratulations, you have a feeling like, okay, the world is getting behind President Biden. And European leaders, they were among the first. They weren't the only ones to send in congratulations like this. I think Justin Trudeau, for example, was very early on. People from the same background politically as Joe Biden. And it worked. It kind of created this climate where, well, world leaders are congratulating Joe Biden now, even though they wouldn't typically be doing that at this stage. And so now we've reached the point where almost all leaders around the world have sent in their congratulations to Vice President Joe Biden.
Now, this enthusiasm for Joe Biden, really, in some ways, it kind of dates back to the Barack Obama presidency and how much antipathy European leaders have shown for Donald Trump over the last 4 years. They're very eager to get this guy out of power, and it seems like their vitriol against President Trump has only increased since the election.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you're right. They love President Obama. There were the massive crowds when he went to Germany, and he had rock star treatment, or even beyond, almost messianic in some ways, the reception when he would travel to Germany. And in the aftermath of the election, we talked about on the Trumpet Hour a week and a half ago just how deranged the German media, especially, how deranged their response was to the election. When they thought it looked like President Trump had won, they were talking about how he was mentally deranged, how he was a psychopath, and how he had the instincts of an autocrat and a dictator. Foreign correspondent for NBC, he said people were reacting like the United States had overthrown a dictator. And obviously NBC is not an impartial, unbiased news source, but I think he's right. once it looked like Joe Biden was winning, that is the kind of euphoria. It was almost like the toppling of Saddam Hussein kind of a euphoria in Europe. I think it really, I mean, it's no surprise that Europe doesn't like Donald Trump. Nobody is looking at this and thinking, you know, oh, wow, I didn't realize they didn't like the guy. But the way that you're seeing them work against this, break with protocol, we've talked in the past about how the Pope responded, you know, throwing the kitchen sink into trying to get rid of President Trump and bring in Joe Biden, it does expose this deep divide that's here now between Europe and the United States.
Now, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has made a bold prediction that Donald Trump is not going to lose this election. And we're watching very closely as this this whole situation develops, and we see these legal challenges running through and developing. But it still seems like the left in America, and you'd have to say European leaders and pretty much the rest of the world, is going to be pretty blindsided when this all transpires the way that we are expecting it to. How do you suppose European leaders are going to respond, or what is this going to look like? What will this do to relations between America and Europe going forward?
I mean, they'll go crazy. You know, no matter how clearly President Trump proves his case, I think he may well prove his case in a way that convinces a lot of people in America. But I don't think he'll be able to convince a lot of people in Europe. You know, he who is convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. I think they'll still be there presenting him as a demagogue, as a dictator, as America's Robert Mugabe. So you could see this implacable opposition. You know, really, we think of the world as the West versus the rest, you know, this alliance between Europe and Britain and America and Australia and these other Western countries. And that would really be no more, I think, in the second term of President Trump's presidency. I think the real danger, though, is America will still act like it's there. You know, President Trump has been standing up to Germany, and he has been, say, drawing down troops from Germany, criticizing Germany's relationship with Russia. He hasn't, though, necessarily, you know, said, well, we need to. He's talked about NATO, but I don't think he's said, OK, well, that's it. We're going to quit NATO now. There hasn't been a big threat to dissolve this alliance. That alliance is still kind of the cornerstone of American security. America still has nuclear bombs on German air bases ready to fly in German airplanes. And I don't think President Trump has said anything about bringing those back. So you'd have this position where Europe is basically an out-and-out enemy, while at the same time they're still a fundamentally trusted part of America's military alliances.
Well, yeah, not just the fact that they would remain in NATO, but that Donald Trump has been actively pressuring Germany to increase its defense spending and to take more responsibility for its own security.
Right, and I think ironically, his re-election could well convince them to do that more than anything else that he's done so far.
So this really is something that is prophetically quite significant. Maybe you can explain that to us.
Yeah, this does leap right out of Bible prophecy. There's a term that comes up in several different books across the Bible, written at several different times, where God talks about, he warns about his people trusting in foreign lovers. And he makes clear that these lovers are other nations, other allies. And Jeremiah 30 and verse 14 talks about this. Ezekiel chapter 16 talks about this. Lots of other places. And God here condemns his people for not looking to him for protection, but looking to other nations for protection, military alliance systems and things like that. And he corrects them for it. And he says, well, your lovers are going to turn against you. You can't trust them. You think you can. But they're going to turn against you, and God uses those foreign lovers to punish Britain and America for not trusting in him. And we're seeing this scenario build up exactly the way that the Bible talked about thousands of years ago. So even though we talk a lot about America being saved temporarily through some of these events, God is still preparing things to correct America, cause America to repent if it doesn't take advantage of that temporary reprieve to do so. The long-run aim is, of course, just to have our nations turn to God so that they can receive the blessings and prosperity that he wants to give them.
Well, thank you very much. Richard actually wrote about this subject in his Trumpet brief on Wednesday. Germany attacks Donald Trump. We'll link to that in the show notes, but you can check that out on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that very much, Richard. European leaders are not the only ones who hate Donald Trump. There's plenty of that within the United States as well. And among those who have this feeling about our current president is his predecessor, who is releasing his third autobiography this next week. And he is weighing in on America's current political scene. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the timing of the release of this book is really interesting. We're here, we're 10 days out from the United States election. We still, or the nation still doesn't know for sure who its president's going to be. Both candidates still claiming to have won the election. We're in the midst of legal battles. We're in the midst of recounts. And now you have this book coming out, which it 760 some pages. So, I mean, it took a while to write. And so he, Barack Obama knew about when he was going to be finished with it. So it's, it was planned for it to be released right after the presidential election. And, it's entitled A Promised Land. And, really, Barack Obama takes the gloves off in this thing and his attack against Republicans in a way I've never heard him do before. Now, he had a slip up on the campaign trail back in 2008 when he likened rural Pennsylvania Republicans to like bitter people clinging to guns and religion. But other than that, Obama's rhetoric's always supposed to bend towards like there's no red America, there's no blue America. There's just a United States of America. But in this book, he really comes out against Trump's supporters as racist, xenophobic, and paranoid. He writes that during his presidency, it was as if my presence in the White House had triggered a deep-seated panic, a sense that the natural order had been disrupted. And then he goes on and says, that's exactly what Donald Trump understood when he started peddling assertions that I had not been born in the United States and was an illegitimate president. For millions of Americans spooked by a black man in the White House, he promised an elixir for their racial anxieties. And then I think later in the book, he really goes after Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as well, saying that she really kind of laid the groundwork for the Trump movement when John McCain picked her to be his vice president candidate in 2008, writing that through Palin, it seemed as if the dark spirits that had long been lurking on the edges of the modern Republican Party, xenophobia, anti-intellectualism, paranoid conspiracy theories, and antipathy towards black and brown folks were finding their way to the center stage. And so basically from, I mean, through those three quotes I've just read, he's, like I said before, taken off the gloves and said that the reason Donald Trump's presidency was possible and that the modern Republican Party was so successful is racism. Takes no ownership for his policies, no acknowledgement of some of the conservative black politicians who have almost won the Republican nomination in the past. And just says this is straight out and out racism is why they opposed him, which, given the timing of the book, you'd think with as tense as the political situation is in America right now, that releasing that book when it was, that you're wanting, you're deliberately attempting to stir up controversy.
You know, what's remarkable to me is Barack Obama is really viewed as almost like an elder statesman. He's a voice of reason and moderation within the Democratic Party. And that party has moved so far left that this view of America and Americans and their support for Donald Trump is it is so perverse and it is so toxic. To think that now it's something like 73 million Americans that voted for him. Essentially, he's branding all of them, all of the support for Donald Trump, including 20% of black men, according to exit polls, that it's all motivated by racism, is just such a distorted view of what is going on in this country and what Donald Trump represents, why he has such support among so many Americans. And yet I just don't think that, as far as the Democratic Party is concerned, that this is even remotely controversial, the fact that he's saying these things. And at the same time, you have Joe Biden out there saying that he's going to unify the country. And this is the message that's coming out of this party, which is claiming to the mantle of leadership over the country right now. There's just nowhere for this to go but conflict.
Right. It really exposes the call for unity as a facade, because, like I said, yeah, right now Joe Biden's saying that, like, okay, well, I won the election. I got my way. I got what I wanted. So now we need to, like, pull together and be united. And yet at the same time, you've got his former colleague on the ballot talking about how, yes, 73 million Republicans voted for Trump because they're paranoid, racist, conspiracy theorist. And then on the other part, the more radical wing of the Republican Party, you've got members like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying that you need to, like, start taking names of Trump, former Trump administration officials, so that they can, like, be blacklisted from getting jobs and things like that. So that there's really, between Obama and the more radical wing of the party, you can see that there's no appetite for reconciliation.
Right.
That is just something that, I guess, Biden, as kind of the front guy, is saying, because he's currently in a bunch of legal battles over whether he can be president or not.
Hmm. Yeah, this is one topic that I think Gerald Fleury has been writing about in very clear terms all along, and just pointing out how toxic and dangerous the view of race that is being promoted by Barack Obama. You know, he's saying these things about Americans, even though he was elected overwhelmingly for two terms by, you know, tens of millions of Americans. And I think if his policies were different, he would have tens of millions more Americans. It wasn't his skin color that caused people to be alarmed at what he was doing. It was his policies. But Mr. Fleury has been very clear that this is leading to race war.
Right. The comments from the book that he's putting out did remind me of comments the former Attorney General Eric Holder made in 2012, where it was right after the Fast and Furious scandal with the U.S. government giving guns to drug cartels in Mexico. And there was concern from the Republican Party about that. And Eric Holder, he came out at the time saying that this concern about the Obama administration arming Mexican cartels was all about Republicans not accepting both him and Obama as legitimate leaders because they were African American. And Mr. Fleury wrote an article that we can put in the show notes at the time, entitled U.S. Attorney General Ignites the Race Bomb, where he really made the point that, he said, as bad as that Fast and Furious scandal was, the Attorney General's comments were probably 10,000 times worse.
Yeah.
In terms of just the type of division they were stirring up in the United States. And then he pointed to verses that we mention a lot on this program in Isaiah 1, verses 4 through 7, about the whole head being sick, the whole heart being faint, the people revolting more and more because the government is weak. Mm-hmm. And is ending with strangers or non-Israelites burning the cities of America with fire. It's a prophecy about race war in the United States in the end time.
Well, we will link to that article, U.S. Attorney General Ignites the Race Bomb, in our show notes. And we really do appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, how Iran reacted to reports of a Biden victory. We'll also look at news out of Hong Kong and the Vatican. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
And now back to the Middle East, where Iran reacted to news reports of a Biden victory in an alarming way. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, there was a new IAEA report that came out that was reported on at Reuters and also Wall Street Journal, which showed that there's a couple of things that Iran is doing now as of this week that it wasn't doing before in its push towards developing a nuclear weapon. Now, one or two of these things were in action around the time of the election and have only come to light now. And so whether or not it was Biden's election that started these off, certainly they knew the direction that it was going towards a Biden presidency before they started to enact these changes, at least as what they would have seen via the media reports. And a few of these things are significant. One is that the IAEA says that Iran now holds 12 times its legal amount of low-enriched uranium as per the nuclear deal that Iran says they're still a part of. And this means that they have got enough low-enriched uranium to produce two nuclear weapons right now. And their breakout, which would mean the time that it would take for them to raise the purity from 4.5%, what it's at right now, to weapons grade, would only take 2 to 3 months. So if they choose to then operate their centrifuges to do that, they've got enough now for two nuclear weapons. The other big change was that Iran has installed its first cascade of centrifuges below ground, of an advanced centrifuge. These are basically the devices that create or enrich uranium to a higher purity to allow it to be used in a nuclear weapon. And there's several variations of these. The most advanced ones are the version 6, and they've got version 4 and version 2. All of those are all advanced. And by virtue of the nuclear deal, they're not allowed to have or to spin the second version of these centrifuges. But they have said, Iran has, that they have installed this version underground, and they're about to install the version 4. And then soon thereafter, they're going to install the version 6, which means the breakout time shrinks because they can now produce higher enriched uranium in a shorter amount of time. Now, what's scary about this mainly is the fact that they are doing this underground. They weren't doing this underground before the nuclear deal forbade them from doing it, that we know of at least. They weren't allowed to do it underground. Now they are actually preparing to spin the centrifuges underground, produce highly enriched uranium, which is out of the ability of international nations, or for say Israel, the United States, to attack. And so that's what makes these new developments highly dangerous.
So it's ironic that Iran is taking these steps now and announcing all of these developments within a very short amount of time, just after the election, at the same time that and in open defiance really of the Iran nuclear deal. At the same time that Joe Biden is saying one of his foreign policy goals is to get back into the Iran nuclear deal.
Yeah, well, it makes sense because Iran is preparing for that eventuality of Biden coming in, as they would see it. And they would be happy to negotiate a nuclear deal with the Biden administration, given that he was the vice president under President Obama when they signed the first one, where they had this massive economic windfall and basically said that, well, we'll just delay our nuclear program by a few years. And so they would be looking for something like that in the next nuclear deal. And so they're probably trying to strengthen their hand for a Biden presidency, show off what they can do if they want to. And so this just amounts to another piece of nuclear blackmail that the Iranian regime is putting forward in the face of the international community and the potential Biden administration. But the dangerous thing about this, regardless of if it's Trump or if it's Biden, is that these steps that Iran is taking underground make it incredibly difficult, whoever's in power, of actually stopping Iran should they choose themselves to go towards a nuclear weapon.
There's no doubt that Iran is getting bolder and bolder in the way that it's conducting this part of its foreign policy, this part of its nuclear development, that it's right out there. The IAEA is watching this happen. They're the ones that are reporting on all of this. This is really what we've been expecting from Iran all along.
Right. Iran tells you what they're going to do, and then they do it. And yes, this is exactly what the IAEA is reporting. And they've told the IAEA, we plan to get to version 4 and version 6 extremely fast of these centrifuges and start using them and producing highly enriched uranium. And so when we see the Iranian regime say such things, we do well to believe them. And biblical prophecy indicates that Iran is going to push towards a bomb. We know that in the Bible, the Iranian regime makes up the king of the south, which is a pushy actor, one that is going to motivate a heavy response against the Iranian regime. And a nuclear weapon or a push towards a nuclear weapon is extremely dangerous because the Iranian regime doesn't have the general the things that would hold back a rational actor from using a nuclear weapon. They believe that chaos could actually is an actual prerequisite for their messianic figure's return. And so having a nuclear weapon is something that they want, and they wouldn't fear using it. And so we should take notice of Iran's developments in this way. It does fall in line with biblical prophecy.
Well, Brent has written an article called Iran Welcomes News of Biden Victory with More Nuke Development. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Over now to Hong Kong. China continues to tighten its grip on the former British colony and to choke out its freedoms. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Tuesday and Wednesday that China's National People's Congress Standing Committee passed a new resolution saying that any Hong Kong legislators who are viewed as supporting Hong Kong's independence or as refusing to acknowledge China's sovereignty over the city should be disqualified from holding office in Hong Kong's parliament. So that was Tuesday and Wednesday, and then after it was passed on Wednesday, China went to work imposing this new resolution. It disqualified four legislators. So these four were deemed as being too pro-independence, and they were given the boot. And what's interesting here is that after these four individuals were disqualified, a large group of all the other pro-democracy legislators resigned en masse. It looks like more than a dozen others stepped down just in protest against China's unlawful new resolution here. And it is unlawful because China convinced Britain to hand Hong Kong over to Chinese rule back in 1997. And when they did that, the Chinese signed a treaty with Britain promising that for 50 years, Hong Kong could have a high degree of autonomy. And so here we are, not even halfway through that 50 years. And these kinds of disqualifications show that China is just in flagrant breach of that treaty. So it's not hard to see why the entire pro-democracy bloc resigned. But the move does carry a cost because it means that now, for the first time since 1997, there are no voices of dissent against Beijing in Hong Kong's legislature. So it looks like just a very sad week for democracy in Hong Kong.
Could you just give us a very brief overview of this former British colony and an idea of how Britain is responding to this? Because this is really violating the agreement that was made when Britain handed this over.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Britain stepped in there in the mid-1800s, basically turned it from a barren island into one of the most thriving metropolises in the world. And as I mentioned, in 1997, they did sign a treaty with China at the time of the handover, stipulating that China would give Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy. And so Britain is really frustrated by what they're seeing happening there right now. On Thursday, Britain said that by imposing these new rules and by disqualifying the legislators, China had clearly broken that Sino-British joint declaration. And now they are summoning China's ambassadors. They say they are considering sanctions on some of the Chinese individuals who are involved in this. But really, it's a fait accompli. You know, China has asserted dominance over Hong Kong, and sanctions may sting some people here and there, but it won't reverse the fact that this territory of mostly freedom-loving and democracy-loving people are now entirely subject to the Chinese Communist Party's draconian laws. So it's just a really tragic situation.
Where would you send listeners for more information about this and to understand the prophecy behind this?
I would send them to Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's article, The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. It really places this in the context of Bible prophecy and shows just how Hong Kong, in a way, is a early sign of what's to come for much of the world.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. We'll finish with a couple of stories from the Vatican. First, a new report on a former cardinal who's in a lot of trouble, and the allegations go all the way to the top. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Catholic Church is deeply mired in a pedophile scandal right now. On November 10th, the Vatican issued a 461-page report on former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. And the report acknowledges that bishops, cardinals, and even popes dismissed reports that McCarrick was both a homosexual and a pedophile and allowed him to stay in power for decades. Probably the most explosive revelation of the report is that even Pope John Paul II, who was declared a Catholic saint in 2013, had received numerous confirmed reports that McCarrick was sleeping with seminarians before he appointed him as the Archbishop of Washington, D.C. in 2000. The report also goes on about what Pope Benedict knew during his papacy about McCarrick's activities, and then gives some of the background onto how Pope Francis eventually came to have removed him from the Catholic clergy when the full extent of just the vile things he had done became public knowledge. And I have an article that will be going up on the website on Monday that'll give really a lot of the background of this scandal and the prophetic context, because it does go very deep, talking about at least three different popes covering from McCarrick. But what you're not getting from the report or even the media coverage on it is some of the reasons as to why they'd have done that. McCarrick was the first Vatican cardinal to set foot in mainland China since Mao Zedong's communist revolution, and was really the architect in a lot of ways of this secret concordat between the Vatican and China, which apparently was this concordat was so important to Pope Francis and Pope Benedict that they really were just turning a blind eye to his serious child sexual abuse so that he could help them restore diplomatic relations between the Vatican and the world's largest communist dictatorship. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, actually wrote an article in 2010 when some new revelations about the pedophile scandal in the Catholic Church came out then, entitled The Real Vatican Scandal, that was making the point that as serious and as vile as these sexual abuse allegations are, there's actually an even bigger scandal in the Roman Catholic Church, and that is their behind-the-scenes efforts to restore the Holy Roman Empire. This concordat with China that they've recently signed is an important part of the Vatican uniting anti-American nations in a socialist coalition to bring down the United States and fulfill a prophecy that they have in Revelation 17 and Isaiah 47 about this false church that reigns like a lady of kingdoms and who gets involved with the kings of the earth to accomplish its political ends.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. We'll link to that. And we also have an article going up on Monday, Vatican Report, Clerics of All Ranks Covered for a Sexual Predator. Andrew wrote that. You can watch for that next week. We thank you very much, Andrew. We will finish by looking at a letter that the Pope wrote at the end of last month with a message for his fellow Europeans. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Last month, Pope Francis published a really interesting letter to the European Union and various different European institutions. It was on the occasion of some pretty major anniversaries, the 40th anniversary of the Bishops Conference of the European Union, 50th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the Vatican and the European Union, and a number of other anniversaries. So he put this this letter forwards, and he really urged, he said, he told Europe, don't consider the past an album of memories. Europe, he said, Europe, find yourself, rediscover your most deeply rooted ideas. Be yourself. Do not be afraid of your millenary history. This letter came instead of a visit that some very high-ranking Catholic officials were planning to make to Brussels. That got canceled due to coronavirus. And in some ways, these could sound like typical political platitudes. But when you look at Europe's relationship with the Catholic Church and what the Bible says about its future, it really makes these statements kind of pop out. You know, here is the Catholic Church, here is the Pope exhorting Europe to unity. He did a lot in this letter to kind of complain that Europe's push towards unity had become bogged down and slowed down. He told them that they had to move forwards much more quickly. And at the same time, he talked about how the Catholic Church needed, or how Europe needed to change its relationship with religion. He called for a healthy secularism, but at the same time, he called for an end to laicism, which is just a synonym for secularism. So it's a bit of a contradiction here. He's talking about an end to separation between church and state, which is really what laicism means. So to him, a healthy secularism still means religion having a big involvement in European life. It just means having what is the right involvement in European life, which, according to, as judged by the Pope. Then when you bring in all of this history, well, that's when it gets interesting, because, of course, Europe does have a very long history with the Catholic Church. So it's a report, a letter here where the Pope is just exhorting Europe to have much closer relations with the Church and to look back at the relationships that it's had with the Catholic Church in the past, in previous times where it was powerful, and revive that relationship.
Well, yeah, remind us of the history that goes back centuries of this church-state relationship here.
It does. You can go all the way back to Emperor Constantine, almost a couple of millennia ago, instituting a close relationship with the church, you know, ruling on church issues. Under Justinian, with the Byzantine Empire, that relationship got even closer. And then you had a whole series of different leaders that tried to both resurrect the Roman Empire and this close relationship with the Catholic Church. So you had Charlemagne famously being crowned on Christmas Day in 800 AD by the Pope. You had the Holy Roman Empire, where the Church was a foundational part of the Empire's government. You had the Habsburg dynasty that brought Catholicism over into Latin America and created this kind of global Catholic Empire. You had Napoleon, who took France from being this radically secular place after the French Revolution and brought the Catholic Church back in, giving it a role in education, establishing it as basically the state religion, and signing a deal with that. Even on to Adolf Hitler and Mussolini, who both signed deals of political support with the Catholic Church as they rose. So you do have a very clear pattern here. And this is a pattern that the Bible talks about. It says that there would be this pattern. It describes what it looks like in great detail in passages like Revelation 13 and Revelation 17. And it says that it will occur again. So when the Pope starts saying, well, we need to return to this pattern, that clearly grabs our attention, because it points back to some history that proves the Bible true. And it's also exactly what the Bible says will happen in the future.
We have an article on the website about this. Pope urges Europe to rediscover its relationship with the Church. We'll link to that in the show notes, as well as our booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, and all the articles and booklets we discussed on today's program. Thank you very much for that, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Albert Einstein: the true sign of intelligence is not knowledge, but imagination. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.